Vintage Sci-Fi Podcast. Welcome to Vintage Sci-Fi Podcast 7. It's great to have you. What did you think about The World's Last Wonder Chapters 1 and 2? It started off a bit slow with discussions about rent, extortionate landlords, and how industrial conflicts in history enabled a rich person to benefit. There was also the common trope in scientific fiction of the time of a stolen invention, though with the twist that it is the patent and ideas that are stolen rather than the device itself. Starting a space opera in contemporary times with down-to-earth concerns is still being done in science fiction TV shows today, no doubt as the mysterious hook to get general viewers to watch a genre they may not normally watch. Chapter 2 indicates the style of story is very much on the left of politics, with discourse on a rich person wanting more, and dismay at their need for invasion, colonization, and annexation of resources. The antagonists even want to take possession of space and the planets, with all their untouched natural store, in the name of the Solomon Fisher Syndicate, and this is discussed in a negative light. This anti-colonial rhetoric, this socialist commentary over 120 years ago, is revealing as it shows that many in Australia were already against the actions of the British Empire, along with anyone that follows these ideals. This also reinforces some historians' views that, rather than 1945 arbitrarily being assigned the beginnings of the post-colonial period around the world, in Australia it was a lot earlier. Post-colonial views were already being expressed in 1900, and the start of post-colonialism shouldn't be defined by when countries broke away from empires or when policies were finally written into law for improved conditions for native people. The start of post-colonialism can also be represented by small actions that demonstrate changed attitudes, such as articles and fiction stories printed in newspapers already advocating for a different way of thinking. Of course, some Indigenous people advocate for dismissing the whole idea of post-colonialism as far as they're concerned, the term post-colonialism should mean that all the invaders and their descendants have restored the country back to how it was, then left. On the science fiction side, there was a fascinating explanation on how the radio motor invention works, using molecular vibration as well as information on the behavior of gas particles. The prediction that the car will get to Mars within 6 months is a good calculation for 1901, considering in 2025 NASA spacecraft, using less fantastic technology, can get to Mars in 6 months. It is interesting that the main protagonist, Apollo Jones, will sacrifice everything to prepare for the trip. This is a notable action of most scientists invested in their inventions and indicates that the writer must have known a few scientists and inventors, with the editor of The Toxin, John Arthur Andrews's biography indicating he was an inventor, it's possible the character of Apollo was based on him. I hope you enjoyed chapters 1 and 2 of The World's Last Wonder last week. This week, chapters 3 and 4 explores the insides of the space car, a visit to Brooklyn, New York, and the addition of an American member to the crew, along with the sudden introduction of a love interest. Ah, romance. It always creeps into space fiction when you least expect it. Here are chapters 3 and 4 of The World's Last Wonder. The author is unattributed, but it was possibly written by Bernard Patrick O'Dowd, perhaps with contributions by John Arthur Andrews and Evangeline Mina Fryer.
Chapter 3. The preparations for our voyage were at length completed, with a day or two to spare, in which we counted upon resting ourselves. After which, it was Apollo's plan that we should ascend to a moderate height, steering north and taking a westward drift, which would bring us to the vicinity of New York at about the time fixed for the departure of the rival expedition. These expectations were rudely disturbed by a mysterious injury, evidently willfully inflicted by somebody, that befell the apparatus. Apollo concluded that Sir Mark Solomon had learned of the building of our machine and had thereupon engaged an emissary to damage it and defeat our probably guessed-at purpose of shadowing. If so, it was likely that Arcturus G. Fisher and Sir Mark would make an earlier start. Fortunately, the harm done was slight, owing no doubt to the would-be destroyer's ignorance of the appliances, and less than 3 hours' work sufficed to make everything right. Upon this, for fear of another attempt, as well as to make sure of not missing the opposition party at the outset, Apollo Jones decided to start at once, and in scarcely more than 10 minutes from the time when the repairs were completed, he stood ready to press the lever that would set us rising. The essential radio motor apparatus was mainly enclosed in a great central tube, or hollow pillar, about which the travelling car was built. Besides the main radio motor, intended to furnish the lifting power, There were several subsidiary ones arranged for steering, it being merely necessary, when not too high up from the Earth, to point one or more of them to the horizon in the direction away from which it was desired to travel. At greater heights, where the thrusts obtained off the different parts of the Earth would be too nearly parallel with each other to steer by, the requisite cross thrust was to be obtained from the Moon as the subsidiary base of repulsion. The car itself was a series of walls or shells, having the spaces between them filled with various kinds of packing, chiefly for the regulation of the internal temperature, but also as a partial protection from the assaults of meteoric stones, which, circulating abundantly in space, might come into collision with our vehicle. These flying fragments would cause a very appreciable danger at the Earth's surface if it were not for the atmosphere, which intercepts most of them and burns them up harmlessly as shooting stars. Inside and outside were connected by numerous small tubes, which, however, did not go straight through, but were repeatedly zigzagged to prevent them from being points of weakness relatively to this probable bombardment. They were mostly windows, through which the feat of seeing round several corners was accomplished by an arrangement of prisms or of mirrors. Others controlled the release or admission of air and were intended to be closed on the voyage, and some were connected with signalling appliances, etc. The chamber could be hermetically sealed from inside after we had entered. Its air supply for use on the way was provided for by chemical purifiers and regenerators. To avoid pollution, as far as was possible, a discharge chamber with airlocks enabled objectionable matter to be emptied out with the minimum escape of air, a very important detail. The greatest weight was in the bottom, partly to keep the principal radio motor pointed steadily to the ground directly beneath, and partly to improve the steadiness of loose objects within, including ourselves, when the influence of terrestrial gravitation should have become weakened by distance. We had various scientific instruments for making observations on our speed and position, of which not the least important was an earthquake recorder, the use of which you would scarcely guess, but it was to detect the rapid passage of meteorites near us and to estimate the deviation which they might occasion, as well as to show the displacement of the car's axis of gravity by our own personal movements. Albeit, by an ingenious arrangement, the main effect of these latter was automatically compensated. But enough as to this for the present. Vaster things and more impressive than any human contrivance were soon to enchain our attention. A turn of the starting lever, and the car, after a momentary interval, slowly disengaged itself from the ground. Setting the accelerator in action, we turned to the observation tubes and eagerly watched the Earth beneath us, first broadening its horizon and then losing detail, becoming a wide, blurred, distant landscape. The observer from a high mountain peak sees the remote background by an optical illusion, apparently lifted above the depressions of the foreground, but dim, vague, like a faint suggestion of a picture formed by the haze. We saw such background pictures come to sight and sink in the foreground, losing their misty vagueness, even though we were not coming horizontally any nearer and were actually, by our ascent, receding from them. This clearing being due to the fact that in looking at them from the great height, we had less air interposed than when viewing them more nearly along the line of the ground, where the atmosphere has its greatest density. Meanwhile, the saucer-like aspect of the whole view became more and more striking, although at a much greater height it was to disappear. These scenic views have been reasoned up to and dwelt on graphically by several imaginative writers who have treated of fictitious voyages into space, but the truly marvelous scene of the whole ascent they have never conceived of. I shall never forget the stupendous spectacle that was presented at a height of some 1,400 miles, when after some slight interruption, I returned to my post of observation and perceived by direct eyesight, the first time that mortal man had ever done so, our globe's actual revolution. At that height, we were approximately at the same distance as the equator out from the Earth's axis and, not having brought the steering gear into play, retained approximately our original latitude. Now, to travel around the axis in a day and a night, a place on the equator has to be whirled around at the velocity of about 1,000 miles an hour, whilst at Melbourne the speed is only some 800 and odd. We, of course, shared in the rotary velocity of the place from which we started, but as the outside of a wheel must move faster than the inside to keep pace with it, so we, in ascending, necessarily lagged behind and were drifting west, or rather being outraced to the east by the ground we started from, at something like 200 miles an hour computed from our level. Yet the apparent movement of the heavenly bodies across the sky was just the same as if we had remained where we set out from. When we looked towards the horizon, the greater movement of the equator, which just bounded our northern view, against the stars, was distinctly perceptible and gave rise to a new optical illusion that the Earth was revolving, not about its axis, but around a line drawn at right angles to the axis, touching the South Pole or thereabouts. At this point, Apollo recalled himself and me from contemplation to the business before us, and the force was turned partly off from the main radio motor. Whilst the steering propeller was set in full activity, this kept us to a moderate rate of elevation whilst traversing the globe, until near enough to New York, when the car was allowed to subside gradually and brought to a standstill. Being fatigued with excitement, I had fallen asleep and was only aroused to a knowledge of our whereabouts by his summoning me to look below for signs of the enemy's machine. As our lateral progress had been of necessity slower than the possible rate of continuous ascent, and we had to get accustomed to the working, this part of the trip had seen the night overtake us, and a new day had just dawned when Apollo called on me to take the lookout. I distinguished in the vicinity of Brooklyn the appearance, surely unusual for the hour, of a vigorous display of fireworks, but the most careful search failed to detect anything resembling a radio motor car. Just then, glancing for a relief through the upper view tubes, I saw what bore the appearance of a powerful electric light flashing through the yet struggling sunlight of the sky. The position was clear. Fisher and Solomon had already started, and the fireworks below and the searchlight directed from their car, that no doubt was it, were an exchange of greetings between them and their friends, who were assembled to witness the departure. I pointed this out to Apollo, and he sprang to the lever board, renewing our ascent with a suddenness that brought both of us in a heap to the floor of the car. The great chase had commenced. Chapter 4. The Abduction. "We shall overtake them," cried Apollo, picking himself up and looking eagerly through the top view tubes. "They have a good start, but we can make pace enough to deprive them of it." He said this so exultantly that I asked why he was so certain. He replied that he had improved the invention since Sir Mark had the last opportunity of stealing the designs. In view of the attempt that had been made to destroy our machine, which indicated a pretty close espionage, I was not so well assured on this point. Time alone could tell. I perceived we were following in the direct wake, or nearly so, of the Annexator. That was the name that, for distinction's sake, we applied to the other car. But we were not so close to it as when I discovered it, because it had been travelling all the time whilst I was making the discovery known, and whether we were likely to lose or gain I could not judge. However, a thought of another kind occurred to me, which was not absolutely encouraging. "Suppose," I asked, "that we should happen to get directly enough beneath them to be struck by the rays from their radio motor, would it not hold us back and have the same effect upon us as if we had collided with a fixed body?" "It ought to," replied Apollo, turning pale and extending his hand towards the steering levers. But he checked himself and broke out with, "Did you notice any damage taking place down below?" The awful significance of the query struck home to me at once. If my surmise was correct, and, as Apollo had said, it ought to be, Then we had left a trail of devastation behind us on Earth, to which the havoc wrought by the most furious tornado were but as the blowing down of a child's house of cards. Wherever the earth end of our rays fell, buildings, trains, carriages, and persons must have been squashed flat, as if a mountain had fallen on them. If the rays struck the ocean, ships that were luckless enough to be on the spot must have been crushed and thrust underwater, and a line of huge tidal waves must have been generated, spreading untold ruin over distant seas and far-off coasts. The thought that we should have been the cause of such calamities was too appalling to be borne. If it were so, then for the sake of mankind, was it not our plain duty to avoid the crime of a million murders and desolations by casting off the radio motor power that very instant and letting the car, with ourselves in it, be precipitated to destruction? I scanned Apollo's face furtively. It was grim with impending resolution. I saw that he was nervously fingering the shutting off lever, waiting, it seemed, only for my answer. And yet, the more I tried to think, the more I was convinced that I had not seen the slightest sign of any such nether devastation, and that if there had been any, I ought to have seen it, could not have helped seeing it. Utterly mystified, I contrived to say something to the effect, yet scarcely daring to express what I believed, so absolutely did it seem opposed to all the logic of science. The pallor on Apollo's face gave place to a flush. "I had not thought of it before," he murmured. "It was criminal recklessness not to have considered. But since you say there is no sign, we may keep the power on to descend by and make sure, though how the miracle..." He stopped, and I simply assented. We had better. The car was immediately lowered until only a few hundred feet from the ground, we staring apprehensively downwards all the time. But we soon realized plainly that our fears had been quite erroneous. The rays had passed to the ground, everywhere as harmlessly as the gentle sunshine. It was a mystery. "Thank goodness for that," said Apollo with a sigh of relief. "Well, I have been priding myself as an investigator for discovering this power, and already it upsets all my conclusions and proves me as ignorant about its real nature as a baby could be. One thing is certain, however. It is a power that has carried us so far and can carry us further just as easily as it can carry Sir Mark Solomon and Arcturus G. Fisher. To be sure, in our momentary horror we had lost all thought of the pursuit, but as this had also caused us to part company with the Annexator, and we should have to rely upon the chances of picking her up again in mid-space, there was not any longer the same urgent hurry. We waited, therefore, to touch ground and purchase the extraordinary of the morning paper, which contained a full account of our rival's departure. Her crew, it appeared, was more numerous than that of our own car, to which we now gave the name of the Pioneer by way of asserting a just claim. Besides Fisher and Sir Mark, there were McNichol Dazzler, electrician, Edgerson Drought, astronomer, and another whom the paper did not mention, of whom we learned in a somewhat startling manner. I was the one who came out for the paper, and I observed that our descent occasioned a considerable sensation, the people thinking that our car was the Annexator, whose actual name, it appeared, we had by a curious coincidence hit upon exactly, put back to Earth for some purpose or other, as indeed it was only natural for them to imagine. In a little while we were besieged by a host of eager reporters whom Apollo was willing enough to interview. For my own part, I preferred to spend what time there remained in taking exercise on terra firma, and for that purpose came out again as secretly as possible. Notwithstanding my precautions, however, I was identified by numerous youngsters as one of the occupants and subjected to a running fire of interjections, such as, "Has it broke down?" or "Take us up along with you, mister?" in every imaginable variety of, to an Australian, uncouth foreign dialect. Amidst all this hubbub, there came to my ears the sound of a fiercer tumult, and looking about I perceived a body of police barring the way to the car against a young man of about 20 who, evidently laboring under some painful excitement, was endeavouring to force his passage through. As soon as I got near enough to hear distinctly, I caught these words of his. "Well then, make them send that girl out." "Go away," replied the police leader curtly, "and don't be meddling with a gentleman that is able to buy all the girls in New York if they were every one of them Dukes's daughters." This naturally irritated my Victorian feelings, and marching up to the police, who had seen me come from the car, I ordered them, in the most peremptory manner that I could assume, to let the young fellow pass. Believing me to be of the millionaire party, they most humbly obeyed. I suppose nothing but that the youth was concerned for the safety of some child that might have gone into a dangerous position with the intention of stealing a ride. But as soon as my intervention had attracted him over to me, I learned that it was a case of abduction. To state the matter briefly, Arcturus G. Fisher had, out of sheer malice more than for any other reason, kidnapped the young fellow's sweetheart. Struck with the girl's appearance, Fisher had on a former occasion obtruded himself upon her in the presence of Fred River, my informant, who thereupon, although as yet no match for him in point of muscular strength, succeeded by dint of a sudden attack in giving the millionaire a good thrashing. Strange to say, Fisher did not forthwith order the young man to jail, but whilst never renewing his advances towards the girl, took revenge by employing various means to separate her from River by the impudent exercise of arrogant power. First, the attempt had been made by ruse, and failed to get her on board an ocean liner at the moment of sailing, when she would have been carried to Liverpool and possibly landed there helpless. At the same time, Fred received an anonymous letter alleging that she had gone to the bad and run away. This plot breaking down by the merest accident in a manner that revealed its real nature, more audacious tactics were resorted to, culminating as stated, and there was no doubt in young River's mind, but Alice Beston was at that moment a prisoner on board the Annexator. Believing me to be one of the other members of Fisher's party, he implored me to use my influence in preventing the completion of the abduction. It was now my turn to enter into explanations, and, carried away by sympathy, I told Fred River that he might accompany us on the Pioneer in pursuit of the Annexator, although the next moment I doubted what good could possibly come of it. Perhaps he did not see it either, but it was enough for him to be on the trail, and he gladly accepted the offer.
I hope you enjoyed chapters 3 and 4 of The World's Last Wonder. Next week, Chapter 5 and 6 explores orbits and the effects of gravity, and the crew experience a flyby of the moon. Thank you for listening.
Vintage Sci-Fi Podcast.